Tuyo.
Hey everyone, welcome to our Euromigos ESMO recap. Tom and I are joined by fellow Euromigo and friend and colleague Silke Gillison. Silke, first of all, congratulations on an amazing ESMO meeting. I know you were involved in developing the scientific program, so not just GU, which we'll talk about, but the whole thing sounds like it was a rousing success. So congrats.
Thank
to you.
You.
Yeah, and everyone involved. I know there's tons of people.
Yeah.
We're going to talk today about kind of recapping kidney, bladder, prostate data from the recent ESMO meeting. And so, okay, we're going to let you start and talk about what you found exciting in prostate cancer, PSMA4, certainly, but anything you want to talk about that you thought was take home from the meeting.
Yeah, so PSMA4, obviously, it's like the obvious thing because it was
Silky, why is it called PSMA4?
Is why is
three?
It called?
Is there PSMA because 3 it's... and 2 and 1? Or...
No, F-O-R-E.
No, it's before. It's before chemotherapy.
Oh, it's really not worked at all, has it? It's not worked for me at
so
all.
So the VISION trial, obviously, was after novel endocrine agent and after taxane.
Yes.
And this one is now before a taxane. So I guess that's how they made the
Hence,
name.
Hence, PSA4. PSA4. Still not working for me.
Thanks for clearing that up, Tom. So
that was helpful information for me.
So, but at least now everyone knows in what setting the trial was. So thank you, Tom. So it's metastatic CRPC, but after a novel endocrine agent without having had a chemotherapy, a taxane. Maybe it was allowed in the hormone-sensitive setting, but not in the mCRPC setting. And you saw, I mean, it was in the presidential, so it was a positive trial for PFS. You know, as always, and we discussed that already in our other podcast, the problematic thing is the control arm that was the alternate novel, I call it novel endocrine agent, it's RP or RC or whatever. So the question is, you know, is that really a good control arm for patients who didn't have chemotherapy? And you know, we can discuss that a long time. I mean, there was a lot of discussion also on Twitter, or however it's called now, X, about that. And, you know, so I think Chris Sweeney did a very nice, neutral kind of discussion, but obviously he brought it up as well.
Okay, can I ask, I don't disagree with you, but when you look at the outcome for the ARPI change group, as they called it, I mean, they didn't do terribly, you know. The waterfall
yes.
PSA isn't bad. What's their median?
Right.
RPFS is like 6 months. I don't know. I just thought they did okay. It wasn't like they all did terribly. Maybe even a little better than I'd expect. I don't know.
Yeah, Brian, I thought, to be honest, I thought the same thing. You know, what was maybe one of the issues here is that they excluded BRCA mutated patients.
Yep.
Because obviously you would give them probably a BARP inhibitor, and that's probably the more aggressive population. But I thought the same thing
what
that
treatment,
you saw.
What treatment did they get, Silky? What treatment did they get? Was it Abby and Enza? Was it just those two?
Yes, I guess that was mostly what was given.
Yep.
And you know, so in that sense, Brian, I agree. I was quite impressed by the response rates in that group as well. But anyway, it's you know, it's kind of plus or minus not a real good comparator arm because these patients didn't see chemo and they weren't unfit for chemo. At least it was not written in the inclusion, I think. But anyway, to me, you know, I think really this lutetium PSMA is a good drug. It's a new mechanism. As Chris put it, it's a new piece of chess piece on our board. We can use it. And patients like it, right? It's usually very well tolerated. It's not complicated. They have to come only every 6 weeks. In some countries, they have to stay overnight. That makes it maybe a bit less easy, but like in Switzerland and in Germany. In other countries, not. So it depends really from your regulators. But, you know, in total, it's a quite well-tolerated treatment.
What did you make of the survival? So there was a huge amount of crossover, which is great.
Yeah.
And their crossover adjusted analyses, which are always a little suspicious. And I know I've done some of those, you know. But when you look at the ITT, the hazard ratio is above one, right? And those curves seem to split. Is there any biology or rationale to saying, well, maybe you shouldn't give it early, that maybe later is better?
To be honest, You know, I think really with the crossover is so difficult to say because it was, I think, 83% of patients who crossed over. That's a lot, right? So I mean, it's going to be very difficult to reach OS in a population like that.
So if you look at it differently, you've got a hazard, PFS hazard ratio of 0.4, and that's a big PFS advantage.
Right.
Okay. And then you go to OS and you end up with, even with crossover, you end up with 1.1 or 1.2. There's a real mismatch. There's nothing that it suggests that PFS is a pretty unreliable endpoint, because you would expect the curves to go apart a bit in some rescue if there was an early benefit. It sounds like, you know, not only are they being rescued, but they're just kind of even doing a little bit better. How does that work?
Yeah, that's a good question. I can't answer it. I think, you know, to be honest, would you really say this is a trend for being worse?
Let me put it a different way.
I don't think so.
Let's put it a different way. Let's you say the existing method for analysis didn't exist, and we didn't have that response analysis, and we said, oh, we've developed this new response analysis, and we've got a hazard ratio of 0.4, but this is the survival curve. Everyone said, well, that's a hopeless time. <It's> hopeless. You know, that would be the conclusion. But we've seen, you know, and we're using a new therapy, and with this new therapy, we're getting really confusing results. How do we move forward with this? Because Brian, you say crossover is great. It's kind of good in some respects, because I know vision has a positive survival signal, and that is important. It would be hard, but not impossible to do the trial. We did renal cancer studies where we didn't have, you know, but don't get me wrong. I think there are aspects of crossover is very confusing, but what we now have is a very confusing result. Because it's very hard to persuade me that you have to have this early. And I think the vision trial looks like it's got a strong, robust signal, which is attractive for patients. And this trial's got as many questions as answers.
Yeah, I would agree. You know, in the end, the vision trial has shown us that there is some effect for overall survival, because there was no crossover in that trial. I think it was correct to do a crossover because, you know, a lot of patients don't have access to lutetium PSMA, and it wouldn't be so fair to put them on a second, you know, novel endocrine agent without giving them afterwards the chance to at least get the drug.
Can I ask a philosophical question? So 99.9% of prostate cancer patients are not getting this drug, as it currently stands in this setting.
In the pre-case.
Not 9.9. Let me say 95. Let me ask what's wrong. I imagine 90% of patients are not getting access to lutetium from a global perspective, the prostate cancer as it currently stands. And so when you do a trial, which only probably accounts for 0.0001% of the prostate cancer population, when you then pull force crossover into that study, it doesn't actually affect the global impact of the patient population that much, but it has 20 or 30 years of potential subsequent impact, because we've not answered this question and we're never going to be able to answer it. Now I understand it's a philosophical question. I can understand a patient coming in saying, hold on a second, you've got a machine, you can give me this life-saving treatment, you want me to take part in this trial, but you're not going to give it to me when my cancer progresses, although I know it's an associated with survival. I can see both sides of this discussion, but this trial has, you know, really not helped us, because we've got this hazard ratio of 1.18, which is not, you know, is obviously negative, and we've got the response of 0.4. These two don't seem aligned. Not everyone got crossover, not 100%. So those 14% that didn't get crossover, but the hazard ratio is still greater than one. And it means, you know, how, because Brian, you said crossover, yes, we have to have it. I'm questioning you saying, are we now in a position where the whole trial is actually not that useful? We perhaps were better off not doing the experiment in the first place because of the crossover.
I mean, Sophie, you can comment. Here's what I think. I mean, we know this is an active drug, right? It had more definitive benefit post-chemo. This trial shows us that, not surprisingly at all, that there's at least RPF benefit pre-chemo, but there's a whole lot to learn about this approach, right? There's a whole lot to learn about timing and combination and adaptive dosing, and I don't know, you know, all of the above, right? There's a whole lot to learn. And this trial adds I don't think there's anything surprising about the RPFS signal here. I think
how many crossovers have you had in the trials you've led, Brian?
Well, not many.
I think the answer is none, isn't it?
I don't know if it's none, but...
Did you do the record one, Everolimus had crossover in it, but I don't right. think any of the renal trials had crossover in it.
Right, and they've struggled, right? Most patients didn't, even if it was built in, for whatever reason. But all I'm saying is I think that my take home from this is there's clear activity of this agent, no question. There's activity pre-chemo, that's not surprising, but because of crossover and because of all these unknowns, we're still a long way from knowing exactly how to use this kind of approach.
And again, Tom, what I would really now... A wait is a bit longer follow-up. I mean, this I can't remember exactly the follow-up, but it's not very long. So I guess, you know, it's also the OS is also not mature. So I wouldn't make too much out of it right now. But I would agree with Brian that there is we know it's efficient, so it does have some effect. And personally, for the patients in the trial, I think it was good for them that they could have the
crossover. And if I was a patient in the trial, I would want that crossover. And if I was enrolling patients into the study, I would want to have that crossover.
Yeah.
But sometimes crossover, you know, every time we put something into a study that's not perfect, every time we do that, we create noise. And every time you put a little bit of noise here, the biomarker's not perfect, the crossover's there, something else is not right, it happened during a pandemic. Each of those has a quarter, 10% chance of causing an unusual event. And that may be why we've got a hazard ratio 1.18 here, which isn't a great hazard ratio for survival.
Yeah, but so... let's wait a bit longer, I guess. And then, you know, in prostate cancer, why should we in prostate cancer always only approve drugs for OS, whereas in kidney cancer, we usually approve drugs for RP?
Oh, that hurts. That hurts.
Okay. Oh, no. Cosmic 313, PFS, no OS, not approved. So that's important. And in the frontline setting, we've always gone for OS currently, haven't we, Brian? Because we didn't, you know, Bevatezo had PFS.
Sophie's right, in the targeted therapy era, it was just PFS, but now in the immune combo, it's
PFS. And we've moved on, Silky.
So, Silky, anything else in prostate? Anything else in prostate before we move on? Because we want to cover two other diseases.
Yes, I guess one thing that, or two studies that were presented maybe with immunotherapy, two phase 3 trials, both negative, one Pembro plus ENSA in mCRPC, one ADT plus Pembro plus ENSA in the hormone sensitive setting, both negative. I think now we should really stop doing trials with immune checkpoints.
Should we stop doing immune studies, immunotherapy studies altogether? Or unselected?
In unselected patients.
I agree.
Because I think now, you know, I mean, these were two really big trials, and I think we should know now. And there's another thing that was in the mini orals was the incidence of fractures from the Stampede patients.
Yeah.
I'm a bit biased for, you know, because I'm a part of Stampede, but this was really like routinely collected healthcare data looking at midterm, long-term fractures in patients, and that was really quite amazing how high the incidence of fractures was, not only in the metastatic patients but also in the non-metastatic patients.
What were the numbers, Silky? I don't remember. Was it something like
something about 20%?
20%, that's what I remember, but seems awfully high.
Yeah, it seemed really high. So I can't remember on the top of my head what it was exactly, but it was really quite high.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, we know that ADT is causing kind of osteoporosis and obviously also fractures, as we know. So we know that since some time, but we probably don't give enough of the bone targeted agent in a sense of prevention of osteoporosis. And I think this was a good wake up call again, you know, to think when you start ADT, because now our patients, it's so nice because they live so much longer. But we have to think about the side effects.
Agreed.
Suki, there was some really neat work on that bispecific T-cell engager, which was targeting prostate cancer. Really unexpected results, I thought. And we had Kevin on the show a couple of days ago.
He did
a terrific gave a terrific account. Do you think that's a new exciting target? How do you explain that finding? It's an immune therapy in a tumor which is described as an immune type desert. Is it something which hit the community as a bit of an unexpected find, or is this something that you've been expecting?
It's a bispecific T-cell engager, as you said, right? So it's quite, you know, it's quite targeted for STEAP1 that is quite high in prostate cancer. So, I mean, I was positively surprised. So I think the data looks really good.
I nearly fell off my seat. I was in the back row. Yes, I did.
Okay. But I think patients have to be quite fit. And, you know, a lot of, as you know, patients with prostate cancer maybe are not really fit enough to do it. But for the many patients who are fit enough, I think this is really an exciting new option. But to be honest, I think we need to have more data. In the moment, I think we have to, you know, the patients have to be in patients at the beginning. So this is maybe not the the most amazing thing for patients. So, but they work on the new applications, I guess.
Yeah.
I think I'm excited. Yes.
Interesting and active, but maybe some work to do to make it more applicable across a common CRPC patient.
Yeah.
You want to move to bladder? I was in a big room at ESMO and I heard applause for Tom, which I've never heard in my life.
I'm not sure
what was happening.
I was confused. I was standing there and was very confused.
You looked confused, actually.
Yeah, I felt confused.
All right, Tom,
I'm somewhat overwhelmed.
Let's go bladder, right? 302-901. You and Mikhail presented wonderfully the data.
So Mikhail presented wonderfully. I was somewhat discoordinated.
Yes, I was being kind, but
sweet of you. So I think
there's a lot to talk about, but give us a big picture summary.
We did a podcast on it, and I thought, look, I mean, for the first time in 40 years, we've got a new combination with enfortumab vedotin and pembrolizumab, which has double progression-free survival, half the risk of death, double the response rate, 30% CR. It looks tolerable. The curves go apart and they stay apart, and it just looked, you know, so.
What's the magic in that combo, right? Because it appears it's not just additive, right? It appears there's some magic there, right?
Yeah,
we talked about all the chemo plus IO, and they've been marginal in 901. You know, I mean, we've talked about that before, but there seems to be something different.
Yeah. So in the phase two trial, the response rates were high, but it was a phase two. But it was in the carboplatin population. And one of the things we forget is that carboplatin population does worse no matter what, because those patients aren't quite so well.
Yeah.
So when you go into a phase three, everyone's expecting, oh, it won't be quite as good as the phase two. But actually the population, the phenotype of the patient was better. And so the results are actually better than the phase two. And the combination, you know, there are issues. There are some immunological issues. And I think Andrea Apollo did a really good little summary of that. We're going to talk more about that in our meeting in Nashville next week. But the story, I think, was that actually a lot of it was about the disappointment with chemotherapy and immune checkpoint inhibition. Because you remember the Atezo study and the Pembro trial were negative. We can talk about the Nevo trial in a second. But they're quite similar in that during the chemotherapy period, unlike in lung cancer, you remember there was a 189 trial, chemo Pembro, where the results were astonishing with hazard ratios of 0.5 and 0.6. And we were expecting the same in bladder cancer, but we didn't get that. We got 0.7s and 0.8s. And actually, you know, the chemo Nevo, chemo Pembro, chemo Atezo trials, when you look at the detail of that data, there are more similarities than differences. They're all in the 0.7s and 0.8s. I think the Nevo trial was well conducted and the statistical power was excellent, and it turned out to be positive, just whereas the Nevo and Atezo trial, well, Atezo was positive for PFS and just negative for OS. It was hazard ratio of the p-value was 0.0051 or something like that. So the Atezo trial was very close to having OS in unselected patients in the final analysis as well.
Yeah.
And I think the answer then is that there is something unusual with, there's something antagonistic with chemotherapy, platinum-based chemotherapy. Unfortunately, avidotin doesn't have that antagonism, and therefore the two are working together additively. You suggest synergistically, and we can have that debate, I think. But clearly there's something really good going on with that combination. And I think that when I presented that, I recognized for the first time, because you get close to things and we've had so many negative trials, But when I was presenting it, I sort of recognised, probably for the first time, that this really was going to make a difference for patients. And
you recognised that on the stage?
I recognised that when someone stood up and started clapping halfway through. I thought, oh my goodness, this is a big deal. And up to there, you always think about, well, it might. Listen, all I wanted was a positive trial because we'd never have one before. I would have bought 0.75, not 0.45. And so, when it was apparent to me that actually this was going to make a big difference, I think at that point I then realized, oh my goodness, we're doing something important. And obviously, it's all about the wider, the tens of thousands of people involved in these trials. And by the way, 1,000 patients and their families and all the other bits and pieces. I think at that point, there was a recognition that this is really going to help people. And what was really positive about it was that a number of people from around the world came to me afterwards and said, I'm going to start treating my patients with this tomorrow. And I think that's a really positive message. And, you and I and Silky, you're the same. We've all had trials before where, there's a positive bit. I think Oliver's study, PMSA4 study is an example where it's a positive study. It's a great hazard ratio. There are questions about controls and questions about survival and other bits and pieces. Whereas this is quite a clean study. There's not that much wrong with it. And I think for that reason, I think people were really, and of course, I think it was, I felt it was quite an emotional, emotional for me.
We're used to picking apart studies and saying, but there's very few results where it's like mic drop, applause. Yeah, right? I mean, in our careers and over the decades, like we can certainly count on one hand those studies, right? Where there's sort of unequivocal, results that impact patients the next day.
At least in some countries, right? But Brian, it was interesting. Sure. Someone told me that in the States, they already started giving the combination in first line, even without the phase 3 trials.
It was approved for platinum ineligible. I don't remember the date of approval, but some months ago.
Okay. Right?
So that's why. And so now, even without a broadening of that label, right? I mean, if a patient
you could already give it.
You could already do it. Yeah. It's
nice.
I mean, you have to call the patient, cisplatin ineligible, but you could do it and, have it paid for, so to speak. I think there was some use. I wouldn't say there was huge uptake, but obviously now it'll be like flipping a switch. So, I saw a patient this week and we talked about, every patient I see now is going to get it.
Nice.
Then Mikhail came after me, and Mikhail did a fantastic job under difficult circumstances. He gave a much more coherent presentation, number one. and number two is he also demonstrated very nicely, and again, we're going to talk about this in detail at the meeting next week. He talked very nicely about the potential advantages of chemo or GemCis-Nivo over what was historically maintenance of avelumab, higher response rates, higher CR. And, it does beg the question, had the 302 data not come out, it would have been a really interesting debate. Should everyone have upfront Nevo? Because who would want to miss out on immune therapy? But the results were less transformative, I think it's fair to say. And we're going to talk about that next week. The next study I wanted to talk about, if I may, was the THOR study, which Arlene from the MD Anderson presented. Is erdafitinib versus pembrolizumab in FGF-altered patients who have previously had chemotherapy. And you might remember at Johan presented at ASCO a very similar trial design, but it was erdafitinib versus chemotherapy in patients who previously had immune therapy. This is different. This was erdafitinib versus pembrolizumab in patients who had had chemotherapy. And we learned from the previous study, the THOR study, for number one versus chemotherapy, that erdafitinib was associated with a 36% reduction in the risk of death, a progression-free survival, and a higher response rate. We also learned that those patients with FGF alterations had a low PD-L1 status. And the original data for pembro versus chemotherapy, pembro was positive. It had a hazard ratio of 0.73. So 27% reduction in risk of death. So some people said, well, pembro is better than chemo, so it was going to be a tough ask. Other people said, well, with low PD-L1 status, only 10% positive, we should be onto a winner. Erdafitinib surely can beat. It's only going to perform as well as it did against chemotherapy, and you're going to get a similar trial. So most people thought this was going to be as, if not more, positive. But actually, we came out with a hazard ratio. I think it was a 1.12. Actually, I can't remember the number. So if I've got that wrong, I apologise. I know it was 1.1 something. And I thought that was really unusual. And it suggests two things to me. Number one is we don't really know enough about the biology. Our friend of the show, Matt Galski, came back to me and said, Tom, actually, if you look at some previous work, it suggests that the luminal patients, the FGF altered patients, have left immune exclusion in their tumours. And I can buy that. I can buy the phenotype being relevant, the immune phenotype being relevant, and to that might make them more responsive to immune therapy. But it doesn't explain the whole story. And it takes a little bit of the gloss off erdafitinib, because now you've got a positive study in refractory disease, but you also got a negative trial. And I think it highlights the importance of immune therapy or of pembrolizumab and other immune checkpoint inhibitors in this disease. And just because the response rate was higher for the erdafitinib, and the PFS was longer, but the OS wasn't. The OS was the same, the number was above one. So I think it's suggesting that erda is good at getting control of disease, but actually if you want long-term benefit in the frontline space, you need immune therapy. And I think what EV Pembro does is EV is exceptionally good at getting initial control of disease, and the Pembro then maintains that control. You might remember we'd looked at the combination of erdafitinib together with an immune checkpoint inhibitor in the Norse trial, and we showed, you know, marginal results. Actually, I think the conclusion of that randomized trial was single agent erda showed great activity, and the addition of immune checkpoint inhibition didn't make a huge difference, which is why we thought this cohort of four was going to be positive. So just as with the lutetium story and this early versus late and the benefit, we've got a similar conundrum in urothelial cancer with FGFR targeting, where we're getting a slightly inconsistent results, and there's no overlying kind of hypothesis that just pulls it all together with a couple of simple sentences.
I think, so here's what I took. Number one, as you've said, PD-L1's an unreliable biomarker.
I'll buy that. Right.
So yeah, we would have expected PD-L1 low patients not to respond and to do worse, but we don't really know that, right? There's other things we're not measuring that are clearly impacting.
I agree. It sinks the biomarker story even more. That ship that was it was taking on a lot of water. it's taken on a lot more water today.
With EV Pembro, that particular comparison I don't think is relevant, right? But it does reinforce that, like any targeted therapy, erda has activity. It's higher response rates, but it's unfortunately low disease control. That's true of every targeted therapy in our world, I think. But it clearly has a place, right? And you might argue, well, in EV Pembro failures who are FGF, do you go straight to erda? Do you try chemo? I mean, that's going to be discussions that'll be had over the next months and years. But I think it was interesting, mostly to me, to reinforce how poorly we know how to select patients for immune therapy. But with 302, I'm not sure that matters much anymore.
And Tom, can I ask you something? So what do you think about the subgroup of upper tract tumors?
Oh, I'm really confused about that. So in the upper tract tumors, in the original Thor study versus pembrolizumab versus chemotherapy, the upper tract tumors seem to be the main benefactor with erdafitinib. And actually the subset analysis and all the bits and pieces that go with that, we need to be very cautious. These findings were less striking in this study, but of course it wasn't a positive study, so it's more complicated. But in upper tract urothelial cancer, we've thought immune checkpoint inhibition to date has been fairly useless. And actually we haven't got great results in the adjuvant trials. The hazard ratios are both above one for Atezo and for Nevo in the adjuvant setting. So we've really been moving away from immune therapy in the upper tract environment. This study we did here, you know, it doesn't point towards that. It points towards the upper tract group having distinct biology. That's the first thing. That the FGF biomarker is not identifying the patients who are responding well to therapy with upper tract disease. Because there must be a second biomarker or a different biomarker. Otherwise, the hazard ratio wouldn't be 0.4 and 0.8. So it questions the whole FGFR biomarker, which, as you know, there are four different biomarkers being developed. And the fact that we're not convinced about which biomarker we should use, the fact that we're getting different results with upper tract disease and lower tract disease, and the fact that we've got this inconsistent result with Pembro with low PD-L1 status still outperforming erdafitinib suggests there's a lot more work to do. And now this has got a whole lot more confusing, because now we're going to be using EV Pembro as a standard of care. And so after that, you know, do you give chemotherapy, platinum-based chemotherapy, second line. I've got to tell you, in the trial, the vast majority of patients got platinum-based chemotherapy, second line. We don't know how they did in terms of their response yet. Or if you have FGFR alterations, you're going straight to erdafitinib in that environment.
Is that randomized trial worth doing? Or is that not really where we should spend time and resources? Should we spend it on biomarkers for ERDA or whatever, you know, as opposed to, I mean, that's sort of the obvious trial, but is that really advancing the field to
Look, the first thing is the Thor group to screen thousands, literally tens of thousand patients or something crazy. So I don't think we should do that again. I think what we've identified is that erdafitinib has activity versus chemotherapy. It doesn't compete well with immune checkpoint inhibition. Immune checkpoint inhibition is absolutely crucial in the disease. It has single agent activity. It's associated with modest progression-free survival, about 5 months, modest overall survival. It doesn't seem to combine particularly well with immune therapy. And there's no frontline trial that's been announced. So overall, it's fair to say that it's an option for patients. What I would like to see is single arm phase two data of 100 patients for a whole string of different drugs post EV Pembro at this point.
Just to do multi-cohort studies or sequential cohort studies and say, let's just see the activity. We don't have to do big randomized, but let's just sort of get a sense.
Short term. Whether you want, if you wanted to bring a new ADC into this space, you know, let's say you've got a HER3 ADC and you want to bring this into this space, then you might say, well, that we should do that study properly to get registration and get it approved. But at the moment, it's fair to say, and perhaps, you know, it's fair to say, and in the US, which is complicated, is what's the role of sacituzumab govitecan sequenced after EV Pembro. And I think that's a very confusing issue because sacituzumab's only got data on 100 patients. It's got 27% response rate. Is it better than gem-cis or gem-carbo after EV Pembro? I would say we're not confident enough to say that at the moment.
Yeah.
So I think we should use platinum-based chemotherapy next, and then maybe sacituzumab subsequent to that. And I personally don't think we should be re-challenging with immune therapy. So if you give chemotherapy second line, I don't think maintenance of avelumab has a role to play after EV Pembro, in my opinion, at this point. Now, if we can show data, show something slightly different, I'd be very happy to see that.
Yeah.
But Tom, I mean, you could really look in your trial. Are you collecting that data? What is, you know, the second line and what are the response rate or even like the PFS2 or something like that? Because
I was hoping we'd get through a podcast without PFS2.
This show's not a great fan of PFS2. We should have given you that warning at the start.
Yes, we should.
Okay, so just say response rates for the second line chemotherapy.
Yeah, we're struggling a bit with that. And of course, their retrospective data analysis. Clinical trials tend not to go, you know, they're trying to look, they're very expensive to do. And while you've got a patient on a clinical trial, it's hard. And when a patient comes off a study, some of the incentive of filling out the data forms drops a little bit. And, you know, the monitoring on those patients reduces. And sometimes the CRFs collecting subsequent therapies aren't as detailed as they could be. Clearly, those patients are not having regular scans and they're not being, and the work's not being conducted in a sort of in the same way as a clinical trial. So the quality of the data drops quite quickly. And so we're going to get data on this. And I think we will get data on things like PFS2. But I wouldn't be using that data as this defined second line therapy.
Yeah.
I think we need to do better than that. And there are a lot of patients whose cancers are going to progress on EV Pembro who are going to have difficult choices about where to go next. So there is an importance in collecting that data. If we want to cure bladder cancer, this is not the best place to do it. You know, EV Pembro refractory disease.
But agree we can cure patients with advanced bladder cancer? Waffled on this in our other podcast.
Well, that was before everyone clapped during that thing. I looked around and I thought, oh God, everyone else thinks this makes a difference. It was just beforehand, I was just looking, I was a bit anxious. I didn't know, you know, how do you interpret that sort of data? Of course, you think it's made a big deal, but it's for other people to decide. And I thought Andrea Polo, by the way, did a fabulous discussion. So I do think we're beginning. I mean, I've got a group of patients with on infortumab, vedotin, and pembrolizumab who are off therapy or on single agent pembro who are having durable remissions 2 or 3 years out. And that's very different from what we saw with chemotherapy. So I think we are achieving that goal. But you know,
I agree. The quantity, obviously there's data to be had, but it's conceptually we know it's possible, at least in my mind. Tom, should we wrap up with kidney cancer?
Yes, we should, but before we go into kidney cancer, we just say there was an ADC doublet study of EV.
Oh yeah.
So EV with SG, 70% response rate. It was a phase 1. Brad McGregor presented it really beautifully. And I think that ADC doublets are here for a proper investigation.
Agreed.
And we need to explore those. And I think we should be doing triplets too. So EV, SG, Pembro, and I think we need to be moving them earlier into the disease setting as well. I think that's how we're going to cure even more patients.
Agreed.
Brian, far away with kidney cancer.
Oh, I thought you'd never ask. So I think most of the RCC data, as you both know, was belzutifan related. So there was a session that had three belzutifan abstracts, 005, which was belzu versus everolimus, and then combo study of belzu cabo in refractory and in frontline, and then a dose finding study. So 005, which Laurence presented, was the big data refractory setting, mostly third and fourth line. Pretty typical modern kidney cancer population randomized to belzu or everolimus, and we can talk about the suitability of that control arm, but actually those patients did reasonably well on everolimus, showed a progression-free survival advantage with really interesting curves, right? Same median of 5.6 months, but a hazard ratio of 0.75. And if you look at the curves, they drop quite quickly, sort of through the median to about 40% of patients remaining, and then they split quite dramatically, which accounts for the hazard ratio and looks like a more durable effect of belzutifan, noting the limited follow-up. So I think what we're seeing is it's not a drug that works quickly, right? Mm-hmm. And with everolimus having minimal activity, that's why you see both those curves go down quickly. But there's clearly a subpopulation, either based on a biomarker not yet discovered or just the biology of the disease that allows time to respond, that can then respond later on. So I think this will get certainly FDA approved. And I think we'll get used really widely because the other factor is that it's super well tolerated. So if this was another toxic TKI, I don't think these results move the needle. But because it's in general well tolerated, I think they move the needle a lot. There was not an overall survival advantage at two interim analyses that are pretty mature. So I don't think we'll see that. And we can talk about how important that is. But I do think the drug will get used.
Let's talk about how important that is now. And let's talk about the control arm. So everolimus has been beaten before by cabozantinib. It's not widely used as a drug. And it was used as a control arm and low survival was seen. I guess the question is, had one gone against axitinib, which would have been a very reasonable control arm third line or fourth line, would you have seen the same results? Or is axitinib?
Yeah, I mean, we don't know, of course. And again, I think, much like as I commented for PSMA4, I think actually the everolimus arm performed pretty well. I mean, 5.6 months, I wouldn't have necessarily expected that out of everolimus. It's actually probably the best it's done.
I think it was 4.6 in record one, wasn't it?
Yeah, a little earlier setting. So this is a little later setting, you know, and in Checkmate, I don't remember all the numbers, but it performed as well or better than it had as a control arm in previous studies. Could you have used a TKI? Yeah, of course, right? I mean, again, remember this trial was designed many, many years ago when Peloton owned the drug. So there wasn't tivozanib, right? That wasn't approved. The TIVO-3 data wasn't out yet. Axitinib registration, as you know, was second line. So there wasn't later line. So yeah, you could have made other choices, but I don't think it's completely inactive comparison.
Someone stood up and talked about crisscrossing of the curves. What was your take on that?
Because it wasn't blinded, I think what you saw is that there was some patients pulled off everolimus. Maybe it was in that 3 to 6 month, wherever those curves sort of cross, wherever the everolimus curve is on top, whatever that time frame was. You see a lot of censoring for patients taken off before confirmed progression. But if you look at the investigator curves, they're entirely overlapping, you know, as mentioned through the median.
Brian, you not talked about the quality of life data, which I thought was really impressive.
Yeah, I mean, so there was two quality of life measures presented. I think there'll be more at an upcoming scientific meeting near you that basically reinforce what I said, that it's a really active drug. As you both know, in this refractory population, they can have more symptomatic disease. To me, tolerability is everything in this setting, right? Of course, efficacy, but I'll give up a little on efficacy for better tolerability. And I think the quality of life data reinforce what we know from giving the drug, that it's pretty easy to give and quality of life's maintained or improved in responders. And everolimus can be a tougher drug to give.
I was speaking to Hans Hammers yesterday. He said to me that there's clearly his take on this was that for a large proportion of patients, it's doing absolutely nothing. And then for a modest proportion of patients, maybe 30%, it's doing something really, really good. Would you agree with that?
I don't entirely disagree. I think the first part is that it's doing nothing. I think So for some people, like any drug, it's not going to work. They don't have HIF-driven disease, et cetera, et cetera. But some of that might be the setting, i.e., even if you have HIF-driven...
He said it's black and white.
It's not black and white. I'm saying there's some gray in patients with HIF-driven disease late, which we don't know what that number is, if your disease is progressing at a pace and we know this drug doesn't, you know, it's not cytoreductive early, you just may not have time to respond. I don't know what percentage that is.
Hands. I can't remember. I think it was Hans who said it. It'd be slightly embarrassing if it was someone. If it was someone else, please write into us. As I said before, we read correspondence.
But I totally agree. There's not much, for every drug we give.
Every 6 months or so.
And this one lends itself more to a biomarker than our other stromal-directed drugs, right? This is a tumor-targeted drug. So we should be able to find a biomarker. It's clearly not just VHL mutation, because that's more ubiquitous than the activity that we saw. So, and I think our friend Dave McDermott said it best, there's a gap here between the activity and the VHL mutation rate, and we're missing something in that gap.
Niraj and Tony presented two other data sets, one with different doses of the drug and one with a combination with Cabo. Do you want to just go through those very fast?
So, yeah, quickly, I mean, the refractory with Cabo had a 31% response rate. I don't know, maybe a little bit disappointing, right? Because Belzu alone's 23%, Cabo alone in that setting is probably close to 30%. So I don't know. I was hoping that response rate would go up from previous presentations, but I think it was the same. The frontline data with the response rate of 70%, the PFS of like 30 months is very impressive, albeit, you know, a large chunk of favorable risk patients and selected in single arm and all those caveats. So I think we all believe the drug could work better in earlier lines because of the biology of kidney cancer, and potentially could work better in combo. And these data sets support that. But as you know, there's two large randomized phase three, one in the second, one in the frontline setting. That'll be the definitive word. I think for Niraj's dose finding, I think it's great to do this kind of study. It didn't show differences. Yeah, there were some CRs in the higher dose that weren't seen in the lower dose, but I think look at the big picture there. It's all overlapping with more toxicity at higher dose. But unfortunately, and I've spent a lot of sleepless nights thinking about titration of oral drugs, in a cohort, you may not be able to prove it, but that doesn't answer the individual patient question, right? There's always variable absorption and variable exposure in oral drugs. And so I don't think there's going to be other studies of this. I think this will be the last one.
Okay, right.
But I wouldn't forget about it.
We're moving to toripalimab plus axitinib. Yeah. We had a wonderful presentation and a podcast, which has been released on this combination. And do you want to just talk a little bit about what difference it makes having a fourth VEGF TKI IO combination?
As Astrid, the discussant went into, you know, the data is very much axi pembro like at a similar stage, not at all surprisingly. The biggest difference it makes is access to Chinese patients, right? They didn't have access to an IO TKI combination, as I understand it. And now that they have this combination, that it should get approved and used. And that's a big chunk of the advanced RCC population. So on a global scale, the biggest difference is just access to a life prolonging, immune containing regimen.
Do you think the FDA and EMA should approve this, although there are no European or US patients?
I mean, it's hard to see why not, right? I mean, the data is pretty similar to the other ones, best I can tell.
Historically, we've always wanted to have the FDA and European Union have always wanted patients.
Maybe it's different because you have these, three other IOTKI regimens approved. Do you know what I mean? If this was the first and only,
argument
may hold more water, but I don't have a super strong opinion. I'm not sure what'll happen or if it can even get filed. I'm not sure how that works, but I wouldn't see why not.
And I think it's just very nice that at ESMO, a trial was presented that it has been done out of China.
Yeah.
So I think, also this global aspect, it's quite interesting, I think.
Right.
I agree.
And of note, the presentant had broke his collarbone and had surgery a week before the presentation.
I didn't know.
Yeah, I know. He told us that on the podcast. So kudos to him for gutting it out. And then how about time we finish up with the TIDE-A study? So this was an innovative Italian study.
I thought it was cool.
Took 75 frontline patients, gave them axi-avelumab for, I think it was 9 months, 9 or 12 months.
9 months.
And then the responders then stopped axi, continued avelumab, and were followed and then reintroduced axi at progression, I believe.
Yes.
And it was interesting, unfortunately, I think the data presented on the patients who stopped axi was, 29 patients?
Yes.
If you look at actually the consort diagram, there was 13 other patients who stopped axi, but outside the window of the trial.
Yes.
So I think there's a whole lot of detail here about these other patients and what happened.
I would have included them. I'd have done a per protocol and an intention to treat analysis, because I think that stopping of those other 30 makes, but I think 29 versus 35 or 45 makes a big difference.
No, I agree. I think there's a lot of detail missing that'll hopefully come out in a manuscript about.
Roberto did a great job, by the way.
Yeah. No, and I give them, these are hard studies to do, right?
And it's investigator initiated.
Exactly. Yeah. So we saw the median time to resumption of avelumab was 16 weeks. So call it 4 months that patients were able to be off. And I think the big question for me is, number one, we need to design trials like this to de-intensify therapy, especially TKIs that we don't need to give forever. Number two, whether to do intermittent TKI in this kind of approach or to do it with shorter breaks more frequently, or maybe you need to give longer combination therapy up front. I mean, there's all sorts of questions that need to be asked and answered, but I think we need to commit to not just putting people on two drugs forever and leaving them there, especially the TKI.
But about 40% of patients of those that stopped progressed within 2 months or something crazy.
Yeah.
And a really high progression rate. And Dina Battle sent you an email, didn't she? And her email, what did it say, Brian?
Well, no, that was about stopping IO. That was different, but...
No. The principle was patients are very anxious.
Patients are anxious about stopping
therapy.
About stopping therapy,
and patients don't like progression of disease.
Well, yes, correct.
And so given the choice between not having progression of disease and continuing, it's an important issue. Because patients like to have their cancers under control. I think it's emotionally important. So stopping and starting these drugs and inducing progression in half of them and causing anxiety, I don't know how much that helps patients, Brian.
But Tom, I think it really depends also from the patient population, right? Because we are now thinking about de-escalation also in prostate cancer, where you have this PSA, a very good marker. And you can like maybe stop the hormonal treatment that has quite some side effects that are bothering for quality of life. So I think it depends really also a bit from the disease.
Could I ask the question to you then, Silky, in a different way, if I may? So if in prostate cancer you stopped the drug on an intermittent process, and within 3 months, 40% had radiological disease that was 30% larger, do you think the prostate community would accept that? Or would they say, oh my goodness, that sounds like we've induced a wild forest fire?
No, but we have the PSA that is a really sensitive marker, and it doesn't happen like that. So, it depends really when, you know, probably if you can select your population with a slow growing disease in kidney cancer, maybe
they did select you know, better risk nephrectomized liver mets patients. So I think, Tom, I wouldn't throw out the whole approach.
Yeah.
Number one, we don't know all the data. And number
two, I'm a great believer in intermittent therapy. I was just hoping that when you stop the TKI, VEGF TKIO would have been strong enough to get control and long-term, you know, durability.
I don't disagree.
And I was disappointed. I was disappointed, Brian, honestly.
The caveat, I'm sorry you're disappointed. The caveats are, number one, that's not our best regimen, right? So that's
actually
a PD-L1
is pretty good.
Not our
best it was Avelumab. It was Avelumab, wasn't it?
It was also nine months.
Yes,
maybe
yes,
nine
yes.
months. I'm 9 months is a little early for me. I understand
me
the trial
me
design.
Me too.
But you know, if I'm thinking about stopping TKI at 18 to 24 months.
I would like to see a trial at 12 months. I'm a 12 month person. I'd like to see.
Yeah, and there's a French trial. We'll talk about this at our meeting. That's doing just that, taking responders at 12 months to any IO TKI regimen and stopping. So there are some other efforts out there.
Do you think
there are
any listeners left after this marathon?
both of our mothers listened to the end. We've talked about that. So, Mom, if you're there, thank you
for listening. Yeah, that's true. I think there's, you know, I think I've been told the best way of burying a secret is putting it in the second half of a podcast. Have you heard that?
Silky, again, congratulations on a great, great meeting.
Silky, that's really
involved.
Important, isn't
Thanks,
it?
Brian.
Wasn't it? It was a triumph, Silky. And I think you did an amazing job. And being organizing a big ESMO is a huge undertaking. I know it's a lot of work for you. So huge congratulations.
For anyone still listening, go to our website. We have live stream links. We have at least 5 live stream sessions next weekend.
Next week.
Friday, Saturday, November 3rd and 4th.
Yeah, we're covering
There'll
some of the topics.
Prizes,
today.
Game shows, maybe some costumes. So a lot going on.
I'm not keen on the costumes. I'll see you soon.
Yeah, we'll talk about it.
Wow, bye-bye. That sounds really good. I want to see all the pictures.
See you soon.
You certainly will. Bye. All right. Thanks, Silky.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.